Our final panelist today is Dan Jensen, who is the Associate Director of Olmsted County Public Health Services in southeastern Minnesota. He oversees the areas of aged and disabled programs, WIC, and public health informatics. In the role of informatics, Mr. Jensen serves as the lead public health coordinator for the Southeast Minnesota Beacon Program. He leads the development strategy for PH-DOC and is a strong advocate for building technical solutions through communities of practice. He was described by the state CEO as public health information exchange evangelist. So, please welcome Dan.
Thanks. It's great to see so many people here. And I'm just kind of curious to get a read of the audience. For those that work primarily on the federal level, if we could just raise your hands, get an understanding. Okay, a few of you out there, and primarily at the state level. A few more hands go up, and primarily working within the local level. And was there any level that I missed? I think that kind of covered it all. So we try to cover both the all three levels, the federal, state, and local level. My work is primarily at the local level, and then once in a while I get asked to come and present with wonderful colleagues that are doing great work. And I think Steve's phone is going off because the mining industry, who's behind public health, is trying to snag him to do some great work. Southeastern Minnesota is the 11-county region, and I work within Olmsted County Public Health. We have a little medical project going on down there that's been fairly successful. You might have heard of it. It's called Mayo Clinic, and they are in Olmsted County, Rochester, Minnesota. If you read much data research, you'll probably see Olmsted County used because they're very well researched. But across that, from that urban environment, we also have a very rural environment moving across the other components of southeastern Minnesota, bringing all 11 counties together. Across public health agencies and medical providers, we have 100% EMR adoption. So that's pretty significant. We're already working within the realm of electronic medical records. We all have different systems, and what we've been focusing on is building these systems to be able to put together standardized data and be able to exchange them across disparate systems. And that's the focus of where my work has been, is to use the standards that are in place, leverage them to exchange data across the existing EHRs. And again, we are recipient of one of the 17 recipients of the Beacon Grant, and that's been driving a lot of our work in the last few years. And for those of you that have seen this slide ad nauseum, I apologize, but we really had a lot of work that was done kind of down in the lower left quadrant, where we were collecting data, and sometimes we would turn it into slides, and we would come to these great places, and we'd say, look, here's the data that we turned into information that said that X number of cases had this kind of outcome or this kind of result. But we were not really rolling that up beyond the knowledge level. It was definitely not driving wisdom, and we were not modifying our practice out of that. So we've really made a strong attempt to modify our organization to become what we're calling an informatics savvy organization, so we can start to not stop collecting data that never gets used up on the upper right quadrant and start to focus on how we're going to use this data to improve the health of people by changing practice and changing outcomes around there. One of the things that I'm going to say stumbled upon, but it was a little more technical than that early on in the process, is that we found out if we're going to focus on healthcare transformation, if we're really going to have this HIE start to work for us and these information systems work for us, we have to connect the left side, the IT, into the patient outcomes. That's where we're going to drive these changes. But we're trying to understand what happens in the middle. So we really can have the ability to have this knowledge discovery through these IT systems, but how are we going to have that roll into new models? And we are really looking for what the secret sauce is that was going to allow us to have that happen. And we think that we really were able to find that. We built, first of all, what we're calling communities of practice. So the left third of this slide really was focusing on the very large medical providers that cover southeastern Minnesota. Again, disparate electronic medical systems, but 100% EMR adoption. Center part, we were focusing on what we would call mid-sized providers. Local public health falls into this, 100% EMR adoption. Again, we also work with community health, community services, social service entities. We're We're also working with mental health centers and starting to bring them on, basically medium-sized providers. And what we would see with them is that while they want to use data, while they have systems in place, meaningful use dollars aren't going to be able to flow down to them because we're not primary care. Unlike North Carolina and Minnesota, the primary care providers are not built into the local public health agencies. We have enough capacity on the private side, so we leave the private nonprofits to do that, and we focus in on population health, and we're also focusing in on targeted case management. Steve had described a little bit of targeted case management in his area. Finally, on the right third, we're really these very underutilized agencies. If you think of assisted living facilities, nursing homes, if you think of school districts, local public health nurses, or local school nurses working in the school environment, really are not able to have any kind of technological base. So we found ways to try and provide these opportunities to come together and build this overall community of practice. And for those of you not running out to the presentation next door, it sounds like they're having a lot more fun than we are. I appreciate that. So basically looking at how we were able to work together within this, we also determined coming together as a general community of practice was not good enough, that we needed to engage all of the stakeholders in this. And I'm preaching to the choir. This is public health. We know this. This is the core of the work that we've done. We've not been able to make advancements in smoking cessation. We're not working on obesity by doing that within our small individual communities of practice. We're used to bringing people together and having these conversations. Now, we don't have the dollars that the primary care providers have. We don't have meaningful use to draw down. We don't have technical advice, but public health does have a lot of experience in bringing communities of practice together, working together to build systems, whether they're population health systems, whether they're health education systems, or whether they're IT systems. We're used to bringing these groups together. So that's a big part of my message, is consider how you can come together to be the public health force to build a community of practice, bring in those stakeholders and work with them in order to accomplish the goals that you need to accomplish. And specifically then, we started to engage individuals, and I'll start to roll into some use cases here. We had an asthma care coordination, which was focused because of especially elementary to high school. School-age children with asthma are a big issue around southeastern Minnesota. So we tried to determine what we were going to accomplish on this. And when we started to work on this, we found that asthma action plans, and hopefully you're familiar with asthma action plans, it's basically a medical provider stating that if these are the types of situations that are occurring with a child or with an asthma patient, this is how you intervene. It becomes an actual doctor's order when it gets into the hands of a school nurse, and they're allowed to use this in their practice. So we started out, and I've just jotted down some data because I never remember this off the top of my head. We have 47 school districts in southeastern Minnesota, and a lot of them have very, very little technology, and the technology they have is obviously focused on education, not on healthcare. We have about 84,000 students in this population across these school districts. We have about 5,000 that we're estimating have asthma levels that are high enough that would require them to have an asthma action plan in place. When we started this pre-Beacon, we had less than 400 paper asthma action plans for those about 5,000 students out there. That's pretty scary. So these school nurses not only didn't understand what they should be doing for these kids that come in with asthma attacks, they also didn't understand what kids had asthma unless those kids were coming through, and that point was really too late for them. So we started to roll together an improvement around the paper workflow, and that paper workflow improvement allowed us to get to the point where we actually ended up with 2012 asthma action plans that were, no, 2012 was the year. In 2012, we had 2,500 asthma action plans in the schools. So we were able to go from, less than 400 all the way up to 2,500. So we were about halfway there just by improving our paper process. Now we wanted to take that into the next step and create an electronic process, and our goal is by 2013 to have about 4,800 kids on there. So in order to accomplish this, we're building a school nurse portal. We call it Kids eHealth, catchy name, and we are really focusing on exchanging action plans. We're initially focused on asthma action plans, but it can be seizure action plans, diabetic action plans, allergy action plans, whatever it needs to be. And we're building this portal. And what we learned through these communities of practice, what we learned by talking to the parents and learned by talking to the school nurses through these focus groups, we actually found out we had 14 focus groups. Seven of them were school and parental focused focus groups. We had 103 participants total. We learned that the parents, first of all, were comfortable in letting their child's asthma action plan come to us as long as it was going to the public health or school nurse professional who is trained in the medical realm and not going to the coaches and the teachers. They were very comfortable if that medical professional took that information, passed it on, and described it so that there was a medical professional buffer in there. They did not want the coaches and teachers signing directly into the portal viewing it. The other thing that we learned is that, again, with so few asthma action plans out there, the school nurses had no idea who had asthma in their schools. So we are building the system so that the school nurse signs in, chooses the school they're working in that day, and then we'll see a list of all the kids that have asthma action plans where the parents have given parental permission. Where they're going to one of the medical providers, all using different information systems, proving the use of the asthma action plans in the portal, electronically behind the scenes that goes into the portal, and it doesn't matter where it came from, it all gets focused down to the individual school, and then the individual school nurse signs on, chooses that school, sees a list of all of the kids who have asthma action plans in that school. Now they can proactively work with those kids or with the district in order to make improvements on the health of those individuals and be prepared in case there's an asthma attack that happens. Transitions of care, another area that we're kind of working in. If you're used to the issue of a patient goes to the ED or goes to is hospitalized, and you have a case manager that's out in the community, let's say public health in this case, and how do they understand when one of their clients has gone to the hospital? We're seeing that we're getting information anywhere from a couple weeks to 3 months after that person's been hospitalized through a number of different quasi-electronic systems and word of mouth with that individual. So really, that inconsistency has really been a detriment to us. However, there are a few use cases out there where the local public health public health nurse has been notified that that person's admitted to the hospital. They're able to go in and work with that client and be able to communicate in a way that allows them to understand what's happening in the community. They understand what the living environment is, what the family support mechanisms might be, what is being seen over this long-term case management. They're able to roll that into a much better discharge plan, and the primary care providers in our area believe that the few times that have happened have actually reduced readmissions back to their hospital if that could be expanded to a wider range. So, here's my fun technological slide. I will try not to get too deep into this, but we're looking at the medium-sized providers that are providing case management within the community in the upper left quadrant. And each of their data flows coming down will basically are just saying, these are the clients we work with, and this is the public health nurse or the social worker or whoever that's working with that client case management. That gets stored into a database at the primary care provider facility. And we have a release of information, so they're coming through with client permission on this. And then when a patient gets admitted to the hospital, when they come through to the ER, or when they're discharged from the hospital, that ADT feed, admission, discharge, transfer feed, comes across that database at the medical provider field. As soon as there's a patient correlation hit that says, hey, we just found out that Steve is being case managed by Dan and he was admitted to the hospital, that I would get a notice as the public health professional case managing Steve that he was just admitted to the hospital or just went into the ER. That allows me to go and communicate with the care team and be able to put together exactly what's happening around the discharge plan with Steve when he leaves. And basically we're saying that allows us to get to a synergistic plan of care at the point of discharge. And again, we have all the permissions in place to allow this to happen. We have legal in place, and we're building the infrastructure to allow this to happen. Our goal is that the lower left-hand quadrant, the primary care provider tool that is going to be able to be used, will be based off of new HIN standards, and we're going to be building it as an open source tool so it can connect in, be plugged into other medical providers that are interested in providing this kind of asset within their community of practice. So again, future expansion is, this is an initial pilot program between Olmsted County Public Health and Mayo Clinic. We're going to expand that very quickly to the other 11 public health agencies in southeastern Minnesota. We're going to expand it into Allina, which is another large provider in southeastern Minnesota, and we're going to look at expanding it into smaller providers and beyond our region, hopefully within the next year or so. med reconciliation. You heard Steve talk a little bit about this. Early on, we talked. I was introduced as working on a program called PHDoc, Public Health Documentation. That's a 25-year project where we have, today we have 27 agencies, started out with 11 local public health agencies in Minnesota, co-funding, co-owning a tool through a cooperative where we're developing this actual software tool that's used across all 11 counties in southeastern Minnesota and another 14, 15, 16, it keeps expanding, counties across the other parts of Minnesota. So this is a couple screenshots of this tool, and this is how we're looking at exchanging health data through health information exchange, using that as our core infrastructure. So on the upper top, we see the CDA documents, electronic documents that are coming into our system because we've requested them, and the patient has given us a release of information in order to ask for them. So we'll be able to honor that by saying these are the organizations that we want to exchange data with, and these are the data points that have come in. Just to be really clear for the technical people out there, and I'll go through it really quickly for the non-technical people, we're exchanging CCD documents under the CDA architecture, and we're using the level 3 CDA documents. So we're using human-readable, machine-readable, and standardized so that we can use that standard of data out there. Med reconciliation, on the left-hand side, this is the meds that have come in from the prescribed side, the physicians have prescribed it, comes from their CCD documents. The upper right-hand corner are the medications that we would have reconciled the last time we talked with this patient because we've been case managing them in the community. Lower right is basically the history, the medications that the client used to be on and has now been moved down to history. For the first time, we're able to have conversations that say, these are the medications that you're showing me when you bring your shoebox out of the kitchen cupboard. That's great, but these are the medications that were prescribed to you, so I was expecting to see these additional medications. Those show up, and I apologize, it doesn't show real good on the screen, as highlighted in a light red. Some people call it pink. I prefer to say a faded red. But those faded red ones are the ones that are not showing up in history or on the current so that you can start to have that conversation of this is what I expected to find. We're able to then bring those medications that are on the left side from the CCD, bring them into our EMR, and save them into current or history. Now, the medical professional is making the choice of what comes over. It's not happening automatically because they need to decide. And some people have given us feedback to say that's inappropriate, but the bottom line is that what's the difference between a medical professional typing in a medication or just bringing that medication in and copying it in? The decision still remains with that individual professional. Once we have that roll together, we're able to put together a drug-to-drug interaction. We have a contract with PEPID, and then we're using the free National Library of Medicine, so we're able to send the medications out there. This is the results that come back from that. So basically, we can understand what drug-to-drug interactions have happened in there. That all gets saved into our system. Now, those are just a couple of the components of what we've been able to build, but the core is that we use a HIE infrastructure to be able to exchange data between all of the disparate electronic systems, not because the systems are the same, not because we've designed a custom one, but we've used the standards that are out there. And we're not asking everybody to get onto the same electronic system. We're saying that these systems just need to exchange data with each other. And then once we have that in place, we're able to start to build systems on top of that that are going to take advantage of that. So a patient portal or a school nurse portal that allows asthma action plans or other action plans to be seen by a school nurse. That's infrastructure built on top of that. We also have built the transitions of care model that I talked a little bit about. We're also building a clinical data repository, so we're using the Regan Street model in Indiana, and we're feeding our electronic data to that, and we're going to be able to do public health surveillance reporting out of that, which is going to allow us to understand real-time what's happening. My long-term goal is then that local public health can put data out to the state, and then once the state has that data available to them, they can start to look into the CDR with all of the right permissions in place. No longer do we have to have local public health filling out forms, sending the forms in, and then having problems of misinterpreting what was supposed to be collected and what was placed on the forms. But if the state can start to pull that data out of a clinical data repository, we'll get better consistency, we'll get better data, we'll get more real-time data at the state level. And then our other goal is that we'll be able to feed more into the state systems. In the last few seconds I'll have left, I showed you very quickly the MedRec model. That was built off of something that we've had in place for over a year called our immunization component of PHDoc. So we can enter in our public health immunizations that we have given, And then we also have a connection to the state registry, MIC, Minnesota Immunization Information Connection. And we're showing the immunizations side by side. Left-hand side, these are the state immunizations that have been presented by other people across the state. These are the local immunizations. This is the difference, and we can copy those immunizations in. But again, that all happens through the use of standardized pieces of data. And putting that together over time, building a community of practice allows us to identify use cases, and then by going out and talking to those communities, not just the providers, but also the citizens that are going to be impacted by this, we can build better systems. And that's kind of the goal of the work that we've been trying to accomplish in southeastern Minnesota. And I have 24 seconds left. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let me just do it by a quick show of hands. Are there any members of the HIT section and APHA here in the room today? Okay, great, wonderful, because if you're really interested in this topic, this is a section that APHA has in case you're interested. See, and you're right there. Boy, right ahead of time. Okay, so they were having a lot of fun next door. And we're going to take a couple of minutes and have fun right now because we need to get up and stand and stretch. What I'd like you to do is everyone stand up for just a minute and introduce yourself to at least two other people in the room. And you can either do it with the people sitting next to you or you can go walk to the back of the room. Okay, if you haven't met that second person yet, now's a good chance to change. Okay, let's start bringing our conversations to a close and start thinking about your questions for our speakers. Okay, if you can hear my voice, clap one. 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 Okay, I think that's pretty good. We just about got everyone's attention. Okay, wonderful. One of the best parts of coming to an APHA meeting is a chance to network and meet new friends and have a chance to say hi to many of the old friends we've worked with over the years. So generally speaking, this is intended to be an open and engaging dialogue session. So you can bring up questions for any particular presenter or for all of the presenters. And if you want to add your own contribution, we'd appreciate that right now. Please identify yourselves as you come to the microphone.
I'm Becky Obrecht, and I'm a data geek from Anchorage, Alaska. And from a personal standpoint, I don't know where the lines, the boundaries are. From being in public health, I like the fact that we share information and we can look at populations from a continuation of care standpoint. I like the fact that I can go to a provider and he can see what this provider has done. I really, really don't like Costco sending me a letter and telling me I'm not really compliant with my medications because they don't take into account the fact that I might be getting it somewhere else. And I really don't like the insurance company telling me that it's not high yet for me to get that prescription filled because I still have 3 days left. So where do we draw the lines?
Well, I think we'll get there when we've got the patient at the center, where the patient is managing all that information. And at least in North Carolina, we've spent so much time trying to build this infrastructure that's never been there to do the kind of information sharing that the real patient engagement part of this has got to come after we've built the system. And I think if the patient is in charge of who has their information and how they want to receive it and whether they want reminders, then we'll get to the right place in that. So I would say it's about the patient.
Just to build off what Steve was saying, I agree that, that definitely the patient needs to be at the center of that. We had a question, a couple of presentations that I did ago. Somebody asked, well, who owns the data? And the reality is that the patient always owns the data. So we're building this clinical data repository that has patient data in it. They own it. They come back and say, we don't want our data in there anymore. We delete it at that point in time. So Minnesota has some of the strongest privacy rights laws out there that I've come across in the country. And all patients are signing releases of information so they understand who's going to be looking at their data, what the purpose is of that. We also have a MRA signed Minnesota research authorization so that we cannot do any de-identified client data research unless that client or patient has also signed off on that to allow that to happen. And they have the right to rescind that at any point in time. And then once it's rescinded, we can no longer use that. So we have built triggers and we've built infrastructure in to accommodate that, to respect all the laws that are in place and to really respect the privacy of the individual. So we think we've been able to try and build that as we go along. And the clients, that the individuals we've had at the table in those design discussions have really reflected that we've done a good job with that. So I think that it is definitely possible. Thanks, Mike.
Not much to add there, but there's a huge effort at OMC around consumer engagement, consumer empowerment, and privacy and confidentiality and so forth. And so I think that, these are the kinds of things that we need to hear at the highest level, at the federal level, to make sure that whatever the concerns are, those things are captured and incorporated into any policy that come out. And, again, that's why we do welcome you all into a lot of these efforts, a lot of the dialogue, a lot of the activities, because these are the things that we need to hear to make sure that, anything that comes out is accounting for these kinds of, concerns where, like, the patient has control on how the information is shared, ownership and so forth.
Deputy Jackson, Kate Johnson, I've got a question for Doug, which goes to what you were just speaking about, which is one of my original questions. It sounds like people come into your system from different places into these systems. And so how do you actually affect that authorization on an individual patient level and get that into a system if they're coming in via this one, that one, or the other? You have several different systems you're talking about. So how do you actually get that patient authorization? Do they have to sign something? Where is that kept? What's the actual practicality of getting patient authorization and unidentified data? Like you said, that their data can't go unidentified into research without permission. Well, then, because then you have to get somebody their name to actually contact them to say, can we use your data? How is that actually, in reality, working? Because that's human interface and paper interface with the electronic system.
Yeah, those are all great questions, and I'll try to do my best to answer them. There is no single answer across any of the programs that we're implementing, so that makes the answer a little bit more difficult. But what we're doing is at each point that the person is connected with, the patient is connected with, at each of the individual primary care providers, whether it's public health or Mayo Clinic or Olmsted Medical Center, et cetera, they are doing a release of information there. We have HIPAA that everybody's familiar with. We have FERPA, which is basically the school side of things, kind of HIPAA for the schools. And then we have Minnesota Data Practices, which is very specific to Minnesota. And we have, and I didn't put the slide up there, but we have an army of 24 legal assistants that have all come together and embedded through these processes. And we've either have consistent or it's the same actual release of information form, or we have approval for each other's release of information form. So everybody in this community is comfortable with the forms that are being used, that it meets the needs within their organization and the other organizations. And then the patient is actually asked to review that and to sign that, and we have training the staff that are engaging with them, and they're allowed to opt out. We have less than 0.25% opt-out rate, very, very, very low opt-out rate. The CDR portion of it, where we're putting data together, is a fascinating story. When we have MRA in place, Minnesota Research Authorization, we send an ADT feed. This is the patient's demographics, admitted, discharged, transferred to the hospital. There's no PHI, no health data, protected health information. We meld those together at the CDR level so we can understand that Steve that went to Olmsted Medical Center is the same Steve that went to Mayo Clinic, but Dan that went to the regional mental health center is a different Dan than who went to the hospital over in Owatonna. So that his data, when the PHI, the health data comes, is not connected, but Steve's data is connected. So that's all handled by registry within that, so we can combine health data across individuals that have given their permission at those points of care, but we can make sure that those individuals are kept separate. And the algorithms to do that patient correlation is probably a whole meeting in and of itself, very complicated.
And a good question, and we exactly have the same problem in North Carolina. Our legislature, as I said, did say everybody's in unless they opt out, which means you have to have a pretty sophisticated system of how you opt out and how you do that centrally so it impacts all of the health information exchange. So that's what our state level HIA has been building. It allows them to opt out at the provider level, the facility level, or an individual visit level if there's something that they want to do. That's a pretty sophisticated system that lets them do that. And then they protect that information that goes across the HIE. What we're hoping is that all of our other institutions and providers will gradually, you know, begin to accept the state-level HIE as their sort of universal consent management for the state. They're not going to quit doing it at their individual provider level. We wouldn't want them to, because that's where the patient can really explain what's happening to their data to that individual provider. Provider explain to the patient. So we're not trying to cut them out, but if we could all agree that there's some central, universal way of managing that, we won't have every facility have to build their own, and we can all build these huge algorithms where you take, you know, an ID number from one hospital, an ID number from a local health department, you know, vital records information, and merge all that together. We're pretty sure we're talking about this patient, very sure we're talking about this patient, and we're managing the information the way they want us to manage it.
Any other questions?
I'm Deanna Barker. I'm from North Carolina Division of Public Health, and I've been in public health in our state since 1996. I've seen information coming from where we are today, which is very exciting in my program, from back when we were all doing paper records. And in fact, I think it's just been in the last year that I shredded reports on that paper with the holes down the sides that were, you know, 2-3 inches thick, that now I can probably get on my phone. But the question I have is really about the financing, the support for our public health infrastructure to be able to get there. And in North Carolina, with what Steve was presenting around our partnership with CCNC, our local health departments in the last 15 months with case management programs for moms and babies, kids, has just gone light years ahead by being able to partner with CCNC and use their informatics center and informatics systems rather than us stack of hard copy paper reports that we really couldn't effectively analyze at all. So I'm just curious to hear about thoughts relative to how do we get public health, how do you get the funding there to get us where we need to be with communicating in, you know, with our partners and all of these other supports and agencies and insurance companies like our folks at CCNC.
I think there's an effort or level at, you know, there's activity that at federal level that are required, there's activity that at the state level and at the local level.
because I think we're, you know, at a time now where, you know, federal funds are starting to shrink. There are some states that are being affected by that, and then I think that just gets propagated down. And so we have to learn to be a lot smarter about the work that we're doing and being creative about the partnerships that we establish. And, you know, we are looking across, like at CDC, looking across programs to see where we can leverage each of those different, say, cooperative agreements better to be able to, you know, loosen the criteria for being able to leverage funds for things like emergency preparedness, for things like non-fatal disease and, you know, laboratory reporting and some of the other programs. But I think that we have to, you know, we have to get smarter about how we use, you know, how we use the money we have, because I don't see any new money coming about. And how can we work with our academic partners in helping us to solve some of these problems that we're confronted with? So we're going to have to, I think in tough times requires, you know, a lot leader thinking about our work and what can we really do. But I think there's a lot we can do in bringing people together and sharing those lessons and sharing the challenges. And because I think there are people at various levels, and then you're confronted with the whole workforce state that I mentioned before. As the workforce is not keeping up with the demand of, you know, addressing some of these activities with technologies and so forth. And so that is a challenge. So there's a lot of, I think, a lot of different challenges at different levels. It doesn't particularly answer the question, but again, at the federal level, we are trying to, you know, address that need, knowing that problem actually exists. And so where you can, you know, where you have ideas and thoughts and areas that we may not be aware of, we need to hear that, because we need to advocate, you know, with our programs, we need to advocate above us at HHS level too.
So, as exciting as all this high-tech money, federal investment in health IT in, at the state and local level is, it is really one-time money. It's over a long period, but it is still one-time money. So that every one of us has had to look at this sustainability issue, how we're going to keep things going. There are good things that we want to hold on to. I like Don Berwick's, you know, point. We spend so much in this country on healthcare that, and don't have the outcomes for it. And we got to take the waste out of the system, you know, start being more efficient, take costs out of the system, and get the money back. We don't need to be spending more on healthcare. We need to be spending wiser and better on what we already have. So there's plenty of money in the system to finance all of this. That said, we are still going to need partnerships with our federal partners and local partners and nonprofits, our example with payers. You got to find their return on investment. You got to find what's in it for them. What is going to be there that makes it valuable in the new healthcare world, not the old fee-for-service world, in the new value-driven, shared savings, outcomes-oriented healthcare system that makes health information important to achieving those goals. And if you do, they'll be there to invest it. Our state-level HIE and the board decided an allocation scheme that really is founded on the notion that health information exchange should be almost a utility for providing health, appropriate health care in your state, so that it shouldn't be based on who has the most money. It should be something that's really affordable and available to everyone, so that instead of fee structure very low for getting started, and we hope we can really even lower that as more people come on with more volume in the HIE, so we can really make that an affordable piece of providing the kind of care that we have for.
From a local public health perspective, our county board really can't afford, as most county boards, to spend resources on this unless there's other ways to have those investments come back. But within our local health department, we actually looked at making some cuts to finance and fund a very small infrastructure of individuals to work on this. And that allowed the seeds of this to be planted early on that did result in the Beacon grant and has resulted in the work that we've been able to accomplish. But everybody's going to have to put a small amount of skin in the game regardless. And then with that in place, you a value add on the return on investment side. This transitions of care model that I just discussed, the primary care providers believe that that is going to reduce, from their perspective, the readmission rates, which is going to allow them to save money. So they see value in that. In working on this this whole school nurse portal, they see value add in that over the long term, and they're willing to put some funding resources into that, which are not grant dollars, which are really ongoing direct funding that they say that there's enough of a value add return investment that they want to invest in this. And the other thing that's coming up, as I understand it, is meaningful use is going to start to begin, that providers are exchanging health data electronically with non-traditional providers. I'm very happy to be one of the first non-traditional providers that are able to say, hey, I can onboard with you, I can, what, you whitelist me, I'll onboard with you, we'll start exchanging data, and there's a value add to that. As soon as we have that in place, I'm walking up to that, providing the value, and sit down in order to meet their meaningful use requirements. So there's ways that public health can really step up and work with providers and provide value that I think providers in turn will provide some money to it. And we've all been in public health long enough to know that we do very great work, very limited amounts of resources. So we're not talking about large amounts of money to be able to accomplish this.
I don't see anyone else with questions right now. This is intended to be a really open dialogue session. And so this is an opportunity while we have our distinguished panel who really are able to answer a lot of questions. I'm wondering if any of you have any best practices you might like to share with your group at this time. In our description of the program, it was very broadly based. It's technological strategies to advance public health. And I'll give you an example within my own field of practice. I do adult education, specifically leadership development, which is focused greatly on residence-based or in-person training. And we're trying to do additional distance learning. And people seem to think that that's going to be the solution to save costs for us by doing distance learning. But there's an effectiveness question about how well people are going to learn if we do distance-based training. It's not just content-rich when you're doing leadership training. So I'm wondering if any people here have ideas about best practices in distance technology, distance learning technology. And I think people underestimate the cost of delivering distance learning. There is also a cost to that. And if you're in an academic program or setting, you probably have more access to those things than those of us who are operating in a nonprofit sector or in state and local agencies. Any ideas? Any other best practices? Sir?
I'm Chris Williams. Thank you for the presentations. They were excellent. And to your question, I think the virtual classroom concept is really a best practice. I participated in a leadership training program, actually from UNC, and with the virtual classroom as well as some on-site interaction, it was pretty beneficial. We were able to augment the residential training with a lot of the virtual classroom types of interaction.
Who sponsored the platform for that?
I think it was Adobe Connect.
Speaking of virtual, we at CDC have just recently piloted a virtual platform for conducting online meetings that is cut above just a typical webinar, but we recently just hosted one yesterday for our Public Health Informatics Centers of Excellence that will be available on our website and an archive that you can actually go and take a look at. We rolled this out in our Public Health Informatics Conference in 2011. That was it was a hybrid conference, so it was an in-person conference and then it was the first part of it. And that was a huge success, so we do have some in the queue for looking at states and local best practice, model practices that will be coming up in July. You know, do stay tuned to our website where we will have that schedule coming up. But again, we're trying to look at every opportunity that we can to share successes and to share challenges so that we don't have to have the same problem repeated, you know, the problem solving of that repeated over and over. So again, my contact information is available, and we can, you know, if I can hear from you to just help us understand how can we as CDC better help you in doing all this huge amount of work that's before us around public health information exchange, around, you know, meaningful use, around non-fatal disease surveillance and so forth. You know, please do reach out because we want to, again, put our efforts in the right place to help, you know, where the greatest need is.
That's great information. We will get that from you, and we'll post that on the meeting site blog so that people can see that information and make sure we get that exchange. I think there are also a lot of issues. I do training sessions on generational issues in leadership and how the different generations approach leadership, and that really is based a lot on the way that they look at technology. So there are incredible implications for us as well in our distance-based education because younger learners are looking for distance-based training. They absolutely do, not just as cost savings, but this is the way that they learn. It's very natural for them to learn that way. Any other topics or questions you'd like to address? A couple more? Go ahead, we've got time.
I'm Elizabeth Hardy from Virginia. Just two quick thoughts. One is what are the quality control programs or measures? And then also, just from the technological perspective, are there any other nations that are just doing great in this approach?
By quality control, do you mean security measures and so on?
I was hearing, you know, different remarks on how quality will be central in North Carolina. Is there a system-wide like TQM model or?
So there's not a one model for quality improvement, but we are coming together in green on the quality measures. So as each program is rolled out, we're making sure that's a component in their electronic health record system so that can be reported up through the HIE and will be much more transparent and ultimately get to the patients. The consumer, again, is going to be the one that's going to be looking up, seeing what the admissions rates and success rates for providers and hospitals. You're going to be able to shop for your health care a little bit like you shop on Amazon.com. eventually, or on a travel site is probably a better analogy, where you can pull up and say what place you're going to, and then decide how you're going to get there. So we really envision that's the way we're going, and it's going to have to be built on some common standards around what are the important performance measures and the clinical quality measures that we're looking for. Quality improvements are a little.
And that's not being dictated from the federal level down. That's just something that you're organically progressing.
So a really good point, and I meant to make when I was talking about it, is all this money coming from the feds and their strategy of building health IT is based on local solutions, local and state solutions. There is no national system for this. There is good national debate on what the standards ought to be, what performance measures ought to be. And there will be some leverage with federal and government providers saying, you can measure and report whatever you want, but if you want Medicare to have, this is what we want to see. So there'll be some leverage with that, but there really is no national blueprint for exactly how we think that we're going to let the states and the local communities try to build this together.
Good question. I know did you want to comment to her?
Yeah, so I actually just want to add very briefly on to that. That my experience in talking with colleagues across the nation is that is the right approach. Because if the federal government dictated a specific prescriptive way of doing it, you wouldn't have the local buy-in, you wouldn't have the state buy-in, and you'd end up with a lot of frustration. But more importantly, I did not realize going into this a couple of years ago that the cultures were so significantly different at different regions across the United States. What works and is the perfect solution in one area of the country is going to be a complete failure in another part of the country because the cultures are just different. And we need to be respectful of that and create systems that are going to honor those local cultures and end up with the best overall successes. And then be able to measure that pre and post. And some of our measures, interestingly enough, have gotten worse because we kind of made assumptions, we're going to reduce utilization utilization, but in fact, some of our early initiatives have been education focused to the point where people are going in and getting preventive care done, and their utilization has gone up. Well, maybe that's the worst thing. Maybe we need to go back and relook at what our measures were and how we're making success out of that.
And there are quality measures as part of Made for Use as well that CMS has mandated. Are you familiar with those?
Thankfully, that's what got me thinking. Just hearing about Made for Use is what got me thinking on that thing.
Right. So providers are required to report on those measures directly to CMS. And so one of the things that I have, you know, learned though, that there are states that necessarily won't get that information because it is being reported to CMS. So how can we help facilitate that information coming back? And I think that's one of the areas that we need to do a better job at the federal level, is being able to, you know, have that feedback. If you're being asked to provide this, then you would want to be able to get a return on, you know, it needs to be a value added for you in sending it so that you can get that feedback back to, you know, take that data to make use of it as well. But that's something that we're working with CMS.
Okay, I want to make one announcement, and then we'll get to your question and your comment.
She covered a lot of that.
Okay, there is a networking lunch after this session. Starts at 12:30. It's upstairs in the second floor, outside the Grand Ballroom area. And it's a box lunch, and the intent is that you can grab a lunch and grab a person and go have another good discussion today. So we want you to participate in that. Around the area of quality and ethics and confidentiality, coming from the great state of Utah and my old employer, the Utah Medicaid program, how many of you have heard of the data breach from the Utah Medicaid program? Just a few people. If you're interested in what can happen when a good system goes bad, Google Utah Medicaid data breach. The end of March, there was a data breach. They assumed that this could have been from people who came into this system, this huge system of data, through an Eastern Bloc country. And as they look back through this, so far the state IT director has lost his job, and additional measures will undoubtedly take place. But apparently, the data exchange, Utah was an early adopter in health data information exchange and had one of the model programs in the country, UPIN, and a huge database. 800,000 people's data was impacted in this data breach. These were not all Medicaid people. The system was supposed to store data as an eligibility determination came in, whether or not someone was Medicaid eligible, and then delete that information within 24 hours. It did not happen. Someone had set up a new server for this data interchange and put on a very weak password, and but for the password on one server, 800,000 people have had data information, including social security numbers, personal information, and medical record information that is out there in cyberspace at this point in time. Very critical, as we're asking people to help give us their information. You can trust us, we're public health. It's been an absolutely fascinating situation. There's going to be a lot of investigation that goes on through this process, but I think it's going to be a lesson in how we turn that around so that people feel like they can trust us with their information again. And most of these people were, many are on Social Security. There were people who were on the Public Employees Program. I'm on the Public Employees Program in the state of Utah. And the idea is that many of the providers, it was people who had been to their provider within the last few months, and many of the provider inquiries would simply check to see if somebody just might also be Medicaid eligible. So it's really interesting when we think that we're pretty safe and secure, these things can happen. So I liked your question about quality and standards and so on.
Well, and there was that other part, sorry to take so much time, but just from a technological perspective and public health, are there other nations, I'm just hearing how
best practices.
Are there other nations that are just, they're clicking on the technological approach?
There definitely are others that are doing better than the U.S. is doing because we are so fragmented in the U.S. It's easy to see how the ones with nationalized health services have more information sharing, but it's
not just those that are doing better out, and you know, I've been talking more about that, but as an industrial automation in terms of the infrastructure for sharing and looking at healthcare differently and public health, you know, this country is despite spending more.
We have two comments here and here.
I'm also wondering about the opt-out and the, as you talked about, generational differences for virtual classes, but people are so used to just clicking, I agree, they don't read anything, whether it's iTunes or Facebook, whatever. I'm just wondering how much of an informed consent there is when people actually check the box or don't.
Well, Charles and someone would have said we are an opt-out state, but it was, that's an important question, and the North Carolina legislature agreed, and that says must provide a meaningful opt-out discussion with every patient. So there's brochures printed, they can do it online, in person, over the phone, in the mail. There's every avenue for doing that, and there's a lot of good information written at a level they can understand about how their information can be used. And even then, our experience so far, and we're still pretty new at this, it's similar to what Dan was saying, very few people are opting out because they understand the value of being able to share this information. Even if all they really understand is they don't have to fill out all the demographics every time they go into a doctor's office, or have to carry their list of medications or their shoebox of medications with them everywhere they go, is something that patients are looking forward to. We are going to have to pay attention to the trust of being able to work with them that way, but they want this if we can just do it the right way.
We have another question.
Barbara Fred from Maryland. And in response to other countries, at the national APA conference last year, Taiwan presented on their system, and they have a smart card where the individual carries their information with them, and as they from one facility to another, this information is available to the next healthcare provider that they go to. And I know that Canada is also traveling in different areas of the country. Do you see technology taking our society and our healthcare information to that level and allowing the individual to make a switch?
I mean, I think as we said before, the consumer or patient is really at the center of it. In fact, I think in order to move this leaps and bounds, it's really probably more at the point of being driven by the patient than anyone else. But I think that we'll have to start looking and exploring, technologies that allow us to do this smarter and better and, be more transportable. I came from working with the Department of Defense and, we had a control environment that we could manage our patient population. You say that it is one system and the general mandate system, and it is such and it is so. And so that made it a lot easier, but when you're in public health, there's like so many different, every state, there's your own different system, and within the state, within the county, there's just so many differences that you have to account for, and it's a harder task to do that. And so I don't know if we will ever have that level of control, but that's why we, work hard to try to have standards in place and make sure that if you are using these different systems, you're using them in a standardized way and exchanging information in a standardized way that helps them to be interoperable to support, one provision of meaningful use of this transition of care to support that better. But I don't know in terms of what the landscape holds going forward. We are taking, advantage of things like the cloud now. We are doing that with BioSense, taking advantage of mobile technology. I think that the future is wide open in this area. Whether it's not smart cards, I'm not sure. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other, but I do know that we maybe did try that within the Department of Defense, it was 12 years ago. Our soldiers were transitioning, wounded soldiers and so forth from theater to theater. But there is potential there.
So North Carolina is having that debate right now. Sort of planning where we go next with that kind of mobility of the information. also easy to lose, which means you're replacing those a lot of times. And what we're leaning toward right now, and that decision has been made, is more of a mobile key kind of concept where the actual data is not in that identifier that the patient has, but some sort of key to be able to get into a cloud where that data is, and then the provider tells you that it's probably a little more of what we're going to do. And not in it, not the same program, more like I think what Dan was talking about, if we can match on all the right demographics on things that the patients already have instead of trying to ask them to carry something else in order to do that, we probably would be better off. And I heard an interesting statistic recently that fast becoming the single best identifier for an individual patient is becoming their cell phone number. How many people have smartphones and how important those are to them and with them, and they're unique to that person, and we might see some interesting innovations around cell phone and smartphone use.
Probably the first thing I need to say is that the phone number has been an absolute nightmare for us because we have a large number of very low income clients who have these throwaway cell phones, and their numbers change so often it's hard for us to keep up with them, and they don't remember what was their number 3, 4, 5 times ago. So in patient correlation, address changing is important, phone numbers are important, but they change all the time. Date of birth is important, and we have a large minority population who were all born on 1-1 because from their culture, it was not important. And in fact, that culture has decided that their year of birth may open or close certain doors to certain benefits. So their year of birth is changing along with their date of birth. And we've also found that within the same culture that their name is very common. So we're struggling with patient correlation on some of these populations. And what we are finding is the last 4 digits of the Social Security number and state of birth, I believe, were the two that really locked it down. Or maybe it was named in the last 4 digits, Social Security number was really locking it down very narrowly for us. But we're not collecting Social Security numbers because everybody's paranoid that's the piece of information that gets lost, stolen, and used to do all kinds of nasty things with your financials on. So patient correlation is going to continue to be a big deal. Our PH doc system, and definitely not a plug for it, but as an example, we were thinking that there may be some benefit to this. So we actually built in the ability where a person could bring like a CD with their data on it or a thumb drive with a customer care document based off of standards. We could plug it into that laptop and be able to upload straight from that. So we've done a little bit from that, but since we built it, we've had a grand total of 0 people have taken advantage of it. So we're just seeing that as a direction at this point in time.
Okay, one final question and then we'll let you out for lunch.
Yeah, it links a bit to what you're talking about is the other kind of quality is the actual data quality. And you know, I work with more research data, so we have to go, yeah, I know how much cleaning I have to do on with them had training nurses, you know, putting in data into my system. How are you cleaning this data that comes just randomly from, not randomly, but comes from all kinds of providers and different people, and it all has to be entered, and how do you have to, what kind of mechanisms are you for cleaning and managing that kind of data?
Yeah, some of the work that we've been doing, so the Beacon grant is what I talked about, and there's a separate grant called the SHARP grant, SHARP N, that's in Southeast Minnesota. The SHARP grants have been working together. Dr. Chu, who is a wonderful presenter, describes the work of Beacon as being the forefront of what people are seeing. He describes the work of what SHARP is doing as the, his words, as the infrastructure that's buried underneath the street, the sewer system. And I'm not sure why that seemed to stick, but people seem to agree with that. So that's work that's going on from natural language processing, and that's a challenge because if you look at abbreviations, that mean the exact same thing, and trying to turn that into data, going into normalization.